I'm Zach. I'm a musician, a former worship leader. I helped destroy Mars Hill Church. Not really sure what I believe anymore, and I am okay with that.
I'm Dave. I'm a Bible theology nerd, an occasional preacher, a movie buff. If I owned a cake shop, I would make cakes for everybody. Oh, and I'm an evangelical.
And this is Veterans of Culture Wars.
Veterans of Culture Wars is a podcast where we have conversations about evangelical Christianity. We welcome you to the podcast, whether you are a believer or not. Another exciting episode. Zach, who is on our show on this episode?
First off, you said if you owned a cake shop. Have you ever made a cake, Dave? I'm just kind of wondering if you'd...
No.
Okay. All right.
Never baked one.
Because I was wanting to follow that up by saying, and I would eat that cake, but I don't know if I would. I would affirm you in your resolution to make a cake for the first time if you chose to do that.
But you don't want to be my guinea pig.
But I'd commit to
honesty.
You don't
want to be the first one to eat it.
I'd be willing to be brutally honest about the results. I'm just letting you know. So I may not be the right person to test.
You know what? Helpful critique is good.
Okay.
I say, okay. You know, because then when I bake the second one, hopefully it'll be a little bit better.
And, you know, just like this show, it's not about arguing. You know, we're not here to argue with each other, to convince one of us that their cake is really, really good if maybe it isn't. We're just here to have a discussion about the nature of cake. On the show today, we have Aaron Green and Paul Carlos Southwick. They're from the organization REAP, which is a great sounding name with Harvest Festival coming up. I think it's called something else by other people, but Harvest Festival. That stands for the Religious Exemption Accountability Project. They are a legal organization that helps students fighting against discrimination at their predominantly white taxpayer-funded religious schools and colleges, both through campus organizing and in court. Aaron represents more of the campus organizing side and Paul the legal side. They have a podcast through our friend Brad Onishi's new network Access Mundi called On God's Campus. The first episode dropped the last week. I believe the second episode is probably coming out the day this comes out, Tuesdays. You and every week Tuesday,
yes,
show? Yep. So
Tuesdays.
So you may have just finished listening to this to their show when you listen to this. Or if you haven't listened to it, it just came out. Go get it. Once you're done with this, check it out. And I got to say, the show has a fantastic logo and a fantastic narrator. My alma mater, Seattle Pacific University's own Chloe Giott, who was at the center of their fight for equality that we had a big episode covering that a little over a year ago. And I see she is now on staff with REAP. Very very cool. Welcome to the show, Aaron and Paul.
Thank you so much for having us. We're super excited. I'm super excited.
Well, so am I.
Paul is too.
Oh, good.
Excellent. We're excited too. And to start, Aaron, do you want to just share, you know, at the opening, we usually have guests share a little bit of their background with evangelical Christianity and growing up with it and what that's meant, what the journey's been like over your life. Do you want to share a little bit of that? And then Paul can as well.
Sure. Yes, I grew up in the evangelical church, like many of us have. I was immersed into it without choice. And then very shortly along the line growing up, I realized that I was not straight, very, very not straight, and had, you know, a terrible conflict in my whole body, just turmoil about being queer and also being a person of faith. But and that's what eventually would lead me to the kind of activism that I do now. But yes, I grew up in the evangelical church. I am deconstructing and reconstructing all the things, but that is a bit of my background. And I also have a biblical studies bachelor's degree from Azusa Pacific University and an MDiv from San Francisco Theological Seminary. So I
oh, wow.
It was important to me to utilize the language that has been used against folks in our community. It was important to me to know what the text, what the biblical text was actually saying, what, you know, and how theology has been utilized in harmful ways to abuse LGBTQIA plus people. So that was something that was incredibly important, still very relevant in the work that I do, obviously, with LGBTQ students across the nation. But that's a little bit about my background with evangelicalism.
Yeah, today I was looking through your blog. I think it's an older article. It was 3 or 4 years old, but I saw that you wrote extensively on Romans 1 and doing that kind of work, going through the historical and cultural background of what that meant. I'm sure you love it when Theo Bros come on X or Twitter and quote Romans 1 to you. Like,
it's my
I've been to
favorite.
Seminary. I've read this hundreds of times. I'm not aware it's in the universe, you know?
I actually did that exegesis before I went to seminary too, in that article, I believe. And my blog is not updated, but that article is still really relevant because I think Romans 1 is, like, out of all the clobber passages, maybe the one that is used the most often that I hear from folks who are anti-LGBTQ. So mm-hmm. Thanks for reading the blog, by the way.
Yeah, no problem.
Research.
Yes, skimming through on my research. Paul, do you want to share a little bit of your story growing up with evangelical Christianity and what that's meant to your life journey?
Sure, absolutely. I was raised in a rural community of evangelical homeschoolers out here in rural Oregon. And so that's where my introduction to evangelicalism started. It was highly politicized from when I was young. So I was doing the Right to Life, you know, Steps for Life, and heavily involved in the anti-abortion movement as a child and through my young adult years. I went to George Fox University, which is sort of similar to Seattle Pacific University, but not quite as big. And it's an evangelical Friends affiliated college. So they're really good on peace issues and women preachers, but they do not like the gays. And they're conservative on a number of other issues. For me, a big turning point was coming out, similar to Aaron. I was put through conversion therapy at the suggestion of my campus pastor. I did that for 2 years, and it was one of the most darkest, or the darkest time of my life. Thankfully, I survived that, and I used that as a springboard to hold the church accountable for what they've done to queer people. And I started doing organizing with George Fox University. I created an alumni group called One George Fox. Similar groups were popping up all over at Biola, where Aaron went for a period of time. There was the Biola Queer Underground. So a lot of these underground or overground student and alumni groups. I also am a lawyer, and so when I started practicing law, I had students that were coming to me who were expelled for being trans, who were denied housing. Someone found a text on their phone about being queer, and they were fired. So I started doing a lot of legal work on behalf of individuals. And then about 3 years ago, is it 3 years ago now? Almost 3 years ago, I started putting together the big case that I have right now, which is the Hunter versus U.S. Department of Education case, where it's a class action on behalf of queer, trans, and non-binary students at religiously affiliated schools and colleges, and we're challenging the religious exemption to Title IX, which allows these schools to do things like promote conversion therapy and expel people, even though they get taxpayer money.
There's a lot of directions we could go with that. Lots of things that we'll want to cover. I've heard you talk about you spent some time at the Alliance Defending Freedom. Now, last week, I guess it was 2 weeks ago, our last episode, we had R.L. Stoller on talking about partially talking about homeschooling things and talking about Michael Ferris, who is the guy behind the ADF as well as the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. I'm wondering if your homeschooling background had some bearing on you getting drawn into the ADF world and Michael Ferris and what he does with those two organizations.
Absolutely. As I said, I was involved in the evangelical political side of homeschooling. I participated in the debate group, HSLDA debate. And for homeschoolers, there were certain kinds of colleges and institutions and organizations that we were kind of ushered into. And, mm-hmm. and I was one of those where I had white Christian men who took me under their wing and ushered me into organizations. My first one was the Family Research Council, which is an the political arm of Focus on the Family, started by James Dobson. It's a very anti-LGBTQ organization, anti-abortion. So I was called a Witherspoon Fellow. I was a Witherspoon Fellow there, along with a number of college students, and we were trained in both the theological and political side of the religious right. That was sort of a ground. That was sort of the beginning of my career in that world. And so when I went to law school, it was very natural for me. And I wanted to work at Alliance Defending Freedom. I mean, it was the cream of the crop of where a conservative Christian person like myself could go as a law student. It was called the Blackstone Legal Fellowship, which many people may have heard because Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett was a speaker at that fellowship, and that was controversial during her confirmation hearing because Alliance Defending Freedom is known as a anti-LGBTQ hate group, as designated by the Southern Poverty Law Center. So Michael Ferris had his hand in a lot of these places, but also did Dr. Dobson and Tony Perkins and a number of other white Christian men who liked taking other white Christian men under their wings and bringing them to be the next generation in this movement. So that's kind of how I ended up there.
Kind of a follow-up personal question. I know while you were at these organizations, you knew that you were queer, and yet you were working on these or for these organizations who were dedicated to, you know, stopping LGBTQ rights. And, you know, if you want to share, and however much you want to share, what was that like? What, you know, was there a tension inside of you? What was that like being a part of those organizations and being who you were?
So as a queer person, you know, first of all, I was closeted. Then I started suffering panic attacks, and that kind of outed me. I basically had to talk about it to my campus pastor, eventually to my family. And, you know, Aaron mentioned Romans and the clobber passages. I clobbered myself pretty much every day with those passages. So that's how I managed to be a vocal and outspoken person for traditional family values, because I was more committed to my faith than I was to my own health and my own life. And so that's how I ended up in those spaces and bringing about those messages, notwithstanding what I called, you know, my battle with same-sex attraction. That's how I referred to it throughout that period.
Can you explain how it is that these schools even get taxpayer money? I think a lot of people, myself included, always thought, you know, oh, private colleges, they don't get public money. They cost a whole lot more, and they have to charge a whole lot more to cover everything because they're not getting money from the government. And then public schools get money from the government. How is it that these private religious schools are able to both get money from the government and legally discriminate despite taking that money?
Sure. When I was a student, the biggest way is through federal financial aid. So when I was a student, I had to take out federal financial aid to go to George Fox University. Did you do that as well, Aaron?
Yes, I took out federal aid for Biola University and Azusa Pacific University.
So that's one of the biggest ways. And if you take federal financial aid or you offer that through your college, then you have to comply with Title IX, which prohibits sex discrimination, pregnancy discrimination, and LGBTQ plus discrimination. So how do the schools get away with it? Well, there's a statutory exemption for religiously affiliated schools who are controlled by a religious organization and who have religious tenets that conflict with Title IX. What does that mean? It's a huge, broad exemption, which means religious colleges, if they want to, they can get all the federal money and they can do all the discriminating that they want to, and they're immune. They're immune from that federal civil rights protection. And part of why that was so important for them was that in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, a lot of them also discriminated against Black folks based on their sincerely held religious belief of the separation of the races and that God did not want interracial marriage or interracial dating. But what happened at that time is the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964, which says if you get taxpayer money, you can't discriminate based on race. Well, there was no religious exemption to that, and they resented it. So they got themselves a big old religious exemption in Title IX. So it's primarily from student loans, but it's also grants, you know, research grants, things like that, contracts. There are other ways that they get that money. And it's to the tunes of billions. I believe Liberty University alone gets $1 billion of taxpayer money every year.
And they have over 100,000 students enrolled, don't they?
Yes, they do.
That is wild. I'm kind of wondering how your approach to your work has changed across presidential administrations. This kind of relates to, so this is sort of two questions here, but there was a story recently about Baylor getting the wording that I kept seeing was they're legally allowed sexual harassment is legally allowed. They didn't say discrimination. All these headlines were saying Baylor wins the right to sexually harass. And that was approved by Biden's Department of Education. This isn't, you know, the Trump-packed Supreme Court. This is the Department of Education. That strikes me as a surprising decision from this administration. So I'm wondering if there really is much difference at all in how you're approaching what you're doing nowadays versus a few years ago. And I'm wondering if you could explain the Baylor thing, if you have insight into that.
Sure, absolutely. So one, you're right. It's a surprising thing from a Democratic administration that is committed to LGBTQ rights. I do want to clarify the nature of that exemption, though. So when a school requests a religious exemption, they have to specify the particular regulations that they want exempted from.
Okay.
So there's a statute, Title IX, that says no sex discrimination. And then there are regulations promulgated by the U.S. Department of Education that say what that means. So they say, you know, no discrimination in housing, counseling services, athletics, a variety. One of those regulations relates to a college's duty to address sexual harassment. So it's not as though the college is sexually harassing the schools per se, the students per se, but what it is they have an obligation if their professors or their staff or other students are committing sexual harassment, they have an obligation to investigate it and to take appropriate steps. So Baylor requested this religious exemption. It's the first and only school to do so. They requested the exemption not only in a whole bunch of other areas, but also for the sexual harassment piece. Why? Well, they said it's because the Biden administration is proposing a new rule that says sex discrimination includes discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And that for that reason, they had to do it because some people might think some of the ways that they approach LGBTQ students might look like harassment from our point.
But it's actually love. It's Christian love.
Right.
There's no love like evangelical love, is there?
Absolutely. The love the sinner, hate the sin, that kind of stuff can be very harassing. And so one of our students who filed a Title IX complaint, what part of her complaint was that people put sticky notes on her door that used the slur F-A-G repeatedly.
Oh, my.
Someone also put a Bible in front of her door with the anti-gay passages highlighted. So what Baylor's trying to do is say, hey, we want an exemption so that the government will dismiss that complaint and we will not have to have it investigated and it will go away. That's what they're asking.
That's not harassment.
So that's how that exemption
witnessing works.
All right. Yeah. And this is really fascinating. If we can put a pin in some of the legal stuff, I wanted to ask Aaron about just coming back more to your story, going to Biola, kind of a twofold question here, because I think, you know, we may have some conservative folks listening to the show. I don't know if they're still out there. But some of them may wonder, like, why a queer person would come to a private religious Christian school, right? You hear that question a lot out there, because people aren't thinking about a lot of the reasons why someone might be at a more conservative school. So can you tackle that question and also talk about your experience of being a part of a queer club underground at Biola? What was that like?
Sure. Yeah, those are great questions. So the question that you just asked about, you know, why are queer folks in these anti-LGBTQ spaces? Why do they stay there if it's so abusive and harmful? Why don't they just leave? Well, it's not as simple as that. But often what ends up happening is that students, you know, during this really the formative years of their life, formative time in their life, age 17 through 24, many of them don't even discover that they're queer or trans or non-binary until they're in college. So then they're there, and then what? Their family's not affirming. None of their friends are affirming. The school's not affirming. What are they supposed to do? Well, that's part of what we do at REAP, is help those students find community, help them find safe spaces. So that's answering part of the question. But the other answer I have to that is, just because you're in a religious space doesn't mean if you're queer that you shouldn't be there. Queer people will have been or have existed and will always exist in those spaces no matter what, whether we like it or not. So I think the better question is, you know, how do we support queer, trans, and non-binary folks who are in religious spaces that are anti-LGBTQ or have anti-LGBTQ policies that are damaging and harmful? And I could talk extensively just about that question, because that's the number one question I get asked all the time is why, you know, why? As if we have to validate our existence there.
Yeah. And I've also heard, you know, sometimes a person may realize they're queer and they have parents that say, we're not going to pay for your college education unless you go to XYZ school. So I think, yeah, when people ask that question, they sometimes don't think through, you know, this is a young 18-year-old and what kind of variables and options that they have in life.
Yeah, I think parents hoping that a Christian college will function as a form of conversion therapy.
Yes, it's a both and to what you're saying. So if the parents don't know and then they find out later, of course they could pull the funding and remove the student from college, you know, from that college. But a lot of times the parents or whoever has monetary control, because imagine being, okay, between the ages of 17 and 24, you don't have financial independence. You are dependent on someone, some authority, whether it be loans, federal loans, or your parents to help out in some sort of monetary way. So if they have control over where you go to school, that's a huge factor. But yeah, there's so many more components to that question that people don't think about, like even transferring. So for example, I transferred from Biola University to APU. It was not easy. Folks who transfer, if they're in the Midwest or the South, might have to completely uproot themselves, financially uproot themselves, move locations. And then on top of that, you have to now adhere to the new college's system for your credits. And what happens is you get pushed back because you have to meet the criteria of that new school. So like I spent an extra year in undergrad because I had to meet the criteria of Azusa Pacific's credit, you know, standards, because not everything transferred over from Biola. So there's just a ton of things.
And that's still from like Christian college to Christian college. I think going from Christian college to non-Christian college, there's going to be a ton of things. Like, yeah,
exactly.
You don't know what to do with your 10 Bible classes.
<You know? laughs> Right. Yeah, exactly, Zach. Like there, I mean, why would, you know, Stanford University accept any kind of credits from, you know, Bible courses or things like that? It doesn't make any sense. So, yeah, there's a ton of reasons why queer, trans, and non-binary folks are in religious spaces to begin with. And I think we need to explore, you know, the validity of their being able, like, worthy, valuable, valued, and their dignity to just exist in those spaces in general. And when it comes to my underground experience too at Biola University, leading that group, I went to Biola University because they had a queer underground movement.
Mm.
And I was looking for a community. I actually did research and found this out. And I was like, oh my God, okay, if I'm going to Biola, I hope they have some sort of queer community. And turns out they did. And then they asked me when I got there to take it over because the leaders were moving to Washington State. So I said yes, even though I had no idea what I was doing. And then I learned a lot about campus activism, faith-based organizing and community organizing through Soul Horse. And I, through protests at Biola's camp, I mean, I became an activist almost immediately and have never stopped since. So that's what it was like. I mean, it was pretty wild.
I'm wondering about, like, practically how campus organizing for you works. I think administrations of these colleges are not inclined to change. And I think they, rightly or wrongly, I would say probably rightly, think they have the upper hand just via the churn of students, where they know that the students that are most effective at getting other students involved and causing the administration the biggest headaches are going to graduate. They're going to go, and somebody else is going to need to step in. And they're just hoping that nobody else does. What is it like trying to build a sustainable, protest movement, group of students that can push back against the administration and maybe even take legal steps? How does that work for you?
For me, as the campus organizer, it looks like very many different things based on the needs of the students at any given location across the U.S. So, for example, like the needs of the students in California might be very different from students at Samford University in Alabama. So we take those things into consideration. But it looks like directly helping, guiding, supporting, and empowering these students to build community, to mobilize, to be able to navigate the world of not just like going to class and anti-LGBTQ lectures and dealing with overt or microaggressions. You know, it's also navigating the world of how do I talk to my president, university president about this? How do I talk to administration about this? How do I navigate that world of negotiations and discussions? It really is a world that the public and like a lot of people don't realize is going on in the background. So besides protesting and besides petitions and all the stuff the public sees, there's a lot more happening behind the veil, you know, behind all of that, that the students are actively involved and engaged with, that really lead up to moments like protests, like petitions, like direct action. So it looks like having our hands in all the ways of supporting those things to help keep students safe and empowered. And yeah, that's the best way I can explain it from my end.
I'm wondering about the layer of, like, I don't know if there's really a parallel for this in non-Christian colleges, but the layer of the denominational involvement. So to take the SPU example, one of their board members was also on whatever they call it, the executive leadership group or board or whatever of the Free Methodist denomination. And the denomination has some impact in what the school is able to do. You know, they pass rules or changes to their way of doing things that says, okay, if a school steps outside of these boundaries of what we say is acceptable within our denomination, we will disaffiliate from them. And that's something that's totally like outside of the campus itself, but still has an impact. Do you do any I don't know, work directly with denominations, or I'm just wondering how that factors in, how that impacts your ability to affect change.
Yeah, so that's actually recently factored in. So one of the organizations we have been talking to are the Covenant Network of Presbyterians. I am also a member of the PCUSA. There are, I believe, a few PCUSA schools that are CCCU colleges. The CCCU is an anti-LGBTQ, one of the anti-LGBTQ organizations that kind of, it's a membership, you know, where you have a membership.
Yeah, consortium of Christian colleges and universities. Yeah.
A coalition.
Coalition.
Oh, it's coalition.
Council.
Oh, council. That's right.
Council.
Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. So it's weird to me that a PCUSA school would be in a CCCU membership, because the PCUSA itself is not anti-LGBTQ. So we have done some small steps of work with that, but I think mainly it's policies, it's school policies, it's school anti-discrimination policies, or very blatant anti-LGBTQ policies that happen all the time. It's really a lot of the things that we also deal with are the inability for these students to come together and form a group that is legitimized by the school, that is recognized by the school. Some of them can't even come together as a community on campus as a queer group.
Yeah.
It's not allowed. They have to go to a church, an affirming church, or a public space offsite. So there's all different kinds of nuanced pieces that we're dealing with on a campus organizing level, you know, besides the legal stuff. But yeah, there's many, many tactics and strategies that we use.
And Paul, I'm wondering if there's tension in your work with sort of the different motivations here. You know, some of your clients may be committed Christians that feel that struggle with the very idea of a lawsuit against another Christian or against anybody. Some people feel very strongly that the Bible says, you know, not to sue people, you know, and then, you know, with declining enrollment numbers, some may not want to add to the financial difficulties that the schools are already facing, whereas some may be perfectly fine to see these schools collapse altogether. What's it like to deal with some of the particular social pressures and feelings regarding these matters with these schools?
So our approach is that we help students and faculty where they are. We don't come in and create crises. What we do is, when there is a crisis, we step in and offer our assistance. So we don't force students to become plaintiffs. We don't force faculty to become plaintiffs. But where people are willing and wanting to have a public face, to have some accountability through the law, then we help empower them to do that, because there's not a lot of lawyers or law firms, and even not, there's really no national LGBTQ plus organization that offers to help them. They kind of get written off by the larger movement as, you know, too difficult, or the Supreme Court will never allow it, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So we offer to fill that gap. There are students who think what we do is wrong and is the wrong path to take. There are faculty who feel that way, and they are completely entitled to feel that. Where I think the greatest chance of success is when you have both an internal movement that doesn't use the law, but use protests, discussions, denominational meetings, but also an external pressure through the law or through foundations wanting to pull funding because they hear about a lawsuit, school districts not wanting to hire folks because of the discrimination. So I think the greatest chance of success is when it's internal and external. But we never force anybody. And we also do not respond with lawsuits to the vast majority of legal requests that we get. So often we work behind the scenes. We try to kind of serve as a mediator between the school and the student to either like help it be easy for them to exit or to compensate them for the harm. So we often don't do lawsuits, which is, you know, Aaron said there's a lot going on behind the scenes, and some of it is legal stuff going on behind the scenes. And then some students, you know, when we get to know them, often they are in a really, they're in the middle of trauma. And if they're in the middle of trauma, and we know that being the public face of a movement or a lawsuit is not good for them, then we also, you know, we tell them that. And we don't want to cause anyone further harm. So we're selective in who we decide to work with. But a lot of people, you know, they're kind of saying, look, we've talked to our denomination. We've talked to our school for 15, 20 years. They invited us to talk, and all we've done is talk. So now it's time for something, another way of advocacy.
Yeah, let's talk about religious freedom, because that's a big flashpoint term, obviously, in our culture right now, with forces that are legally battling with many cases, and the Supreme Court has had many cases. Religious freedom in the First Amendment, obviously, and I think we all agree people should be free to believe or not believe what they want. But the way that religious freedom is being used is the point that we should talk about here. And I, you know, as a joke, brought up the masterpiece cake shop, I think is the name, Jack Phillips, who in Colorado has been in the news with refusing to bake a cake for a queer couple. You know, to me, even if I was a person that had unaffirming theology, this case is completely absurd to me. Because, you know, a guy that's a retailer that's selling a cake, somebody purchases it, then they own the cake and they take it to do what they want with the cake. And I'm not really involved in that at all. But the way religious freedom is being targeted is, you know, if I had unaffirming theology, I don't have to provide somebody with a good or a service because I, quote unquote, disagree with their lifestyle. And then there's a real question of how far will this go? If I was an apartment owner and I had unaffirming theology and a queer couple wanted to rent from me and I said no, this is a matter of housing, right? This is a human need. And sometimes it's not easy to go look for another house because there's variables such as price, location to and from a job or family or a support network or you know, the many different reasons people may want to live somewhere. So for either of you, how have you seen religious freedom, I would say, abused and maybe used as a weapon to try to get out of just, you know, if I have a public business, all kinds of people who are taxpayers are going to walk in and frequent my public business and need those goods and services for whatever reason.
From my, like, from a theological perspective, this has never made sense to me, because with the cake thing or the flowers for a wedding or whatever, because if you're basing it on, if this person is basing it on, like, that is a sin, you know, to be queer or to be trans or whatever, that I'm determining, or they're interpreting that as sin, so they're withholding the goods and service from that person. Well, my question is, do they do that for divorced straight people? Do they Good do question. That? Do they do that for everybody who is, because we all sin, quote unquote, air quotes, right? So if that's the case, why are they not doing that, you know, sin management ideology for every single person that they're providing goods and services to? Why is it just for queer people, or other religions or minorities or disabled folks or something like that? So that was always, that's my question with that kind of logic and reasoning. But I'm sure. Yeah. So that's my thought on it.
Imagine
too much
Christian
pizza the other day. I committed gluttony. I committed gluttony. Is a restaurant going to shut me off from eating more? You know, sorry,
exactly.
Zach.
Exactly.
I'm thinking
yes,
of a Christian car dealership that doesn't sell any cars because they know eventually that driver is going to break the speed limit.
So exactly. So who made them the determiner, like the entity that determines what is sin or against their religious belief? It's very strange to me. So that's my perspective on it.
I can offer a more like legal kind of response to that.
Absolutely.
I'd mentioned a few things. First of all, as a practicing attorney who has a lot of experience in this area of the First Amendment, religious freedom, my view is that these cases about cakes and flowers and photographers are a huge distraction. They are not the hills we should be dying on. I'm sorry, but if you are a white middle class, upper middle class person who didn't get flowers at your wedding, that sucks. But that is a very different kind of harm than if you are a 17-year-old trans kid sent to conversion therapy and kicked out of their dorm with 24 hours with no place to live. That is where the real harm and the real focus. But the religious right doesn't want you to focus there because, you know what? Those kinds of young people are very sympathetic to the public. So they don't want those to be the cases. They want to have their own sympathetic plaintiff, the baker, the florist who's being harmed. They want to center those people. I think those cases are very distracting, and there's a whole split in the movement for queer rights about whether marriage was the right way to go or whether protecting Black trans women was the right way to go. So how I come to see this is you should have religious freedom to believe anything you want. You should also have the freedom to practice your religion. But there are lines that are drawn in a pluralistic society. Some factors are whether you are harming a third party. If you are harming a third party, you don't generally get to do that and say religion. For example, the Catholic Church with Catholic schools and priests who have abused, now we know, thousands or, you know, tens of thousands of kids over decades. They tried to get out of those cases by claiming religious liberty, religious freedom.
That is just,
but as a society, we have said, no, you do not get to move priests from school to school and escape liability for all that sexual abuse. As a society, we also said, no, you don't get to use religion to deny a Black person access to your bed and breakfast, access to your restaurant, even access to your publicly funded religious school. Society and all the courts, the Supreme Court, drew a hard line in the sand saying the IRS can yank your tax exempt status if you are a Bob Jones University and you prohibit interracial dating. And they did so till the year 2000, by the way. We've drawn a hard line in the sand. So why not queer people? Why not trans people? Why not non-binary people? Why not women? Why not pregnant people? Well, I think the answer is that our society doesn't care enough to protect those kind of marginalized people. That is changing. It's changing dramatically, especially among the youth. The youth see that discrimination as tantamount to discrimination based on race. And so part of what the organizing really is that there are committed evangelical Christians, especially 35 and younger, who are equally committed to the Bible, to their evangelical church, and to human rights. That's where the hope in the future is. I don't think we're going to convince a 70-year-old rich white guy who's on the board of one of these schools or who's head of one of these denominations to change. That's kind of almost a waste of time.
Right.
But these 35 and under, and especially the youth, they are changing things. And that will have an effect not only on denominations, but also on the law.
Well, in the case of SPU, the board member that caused so many problems and pushed back so hard, who is also part of the Free Methodist Church executive group, is now gone from both groups. And I have friends who are professors there. I've talked to them, and they said they heard that the Free Methodists were not happy with his shenanigans, although it remains to be seen if much is going to change from the board in the way that it is now structured, at least at the denominational level. But yeah, what you just said about, like, you know, there are queer people in these spaces who are committed Christians. Over and over and over, the message that I got with when I, anytime I talk to somebody, you know, a student or a professor at SPU, in the thick of things that were going on, June of 2022, was all we are trying to do is update the language so that it reflects the community that this already is. We are not trying to change the school. We are trying to recognize what the school is currently. And that's what the board fights against. But that was a really powerful thing to understand that these are not movements to fundamentally alter these religious schools and the communities that they have there, because those people always have existed and do exist. And thanks to your efforts are connecting and getting to know each other better and recognize some of their power in these situations and trying to exercise it when they're able to, learning about more ways they can do that. It really is wonderful to see, and it's really amazing to me, because I did not see much of that at all while I was there. I always like to say, so I was there 2000 2004, and while I was there, the students voted down a change that would have allowed dancing.
Oh my lord.
Like, even the waltz, you can't do the waltz at Seattle Pacific University 20 years ago.
Just organized. I mean, I was just like, I don't care. Like, this isn't high school. Why would we have a college dance? But, you know, small enough campus, I guess you could do that. But social dancing or whatever, I think is what they called it. But yeah, there was enough students there that were conservative enough to be like, I don't trust my body with rhythm. You know, like, I don't want to mess with this. And they voted it down. And I can't imagine that being the case nowadays. I think the campus is so different, and it's, I'm so happy that I know people that work there. And you know, I know a queer professor there, but I know lots of people that I hear good updates on the community there, but at the same time, they just announced 40% of the staff are getting laid off, like, at the end of this year. And ugh. All colleges are facing the demographic cliff of, like, people from the 2008 financial collapse, like, didn't have kids. My wife was in the third trimester when the economy collapsed, so we didn't really have a choice. Don't recommend, if you make a time machine, don't go back to 2008 and start a family then. Not fun at all. But yeah, I'm so happy to see that these places are becoming safer spaces for the kids, even if the board is not allowing them to fully express themselves, they are finding ways to, and they are making important connections with each other. They're speaking up, and things are happening, and you're helping them find their voice. And I think that's phenomenal. So thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about your work. Oh, and before you go, can you talk a little about the podcast? I've listened to the first episode twice. I can't wait to hear what you got coming. I assume, you know, you're doing the standard like 200 episodes.
No. Oh my God. It was it was a very difficult project because it was our first time doing a podcast. So, you know, we were a little new to the scene, it's going to be 8 episodes. One launching every week. Obviously, episode 1 is dropped, so go check it out on God's Campus wherever you listen to podcasts. But one of the reasons why we wanted to do the podcast was for culture change reasons, for public educational reasons. So when it comes to white supremacy and Christian nationalism, we wanted to expose religious educational institutions and their part in this process, in the systemic, you know, implementation or dissemination of white Christian supremacy. Because what we do is, I think a lot of us like to blame churches for those kinds of things, for that in particular. But something that we're trying to say is, well, wait a minute, where do pastors come from? Where do judges come from? Where do politicians come from? They are coming from religious educational institutions. Mm-hmm. They are the ones programmed, disseminating this information into systems like government, you know, other places, churches. We wanted to expose the racist roots of religious education. Paul mentioned, earlier, like Bob Jones University and these schools starting out as segregation academies, many of them. And now this iteration of their queerphobic, transphobic policies, and seeking Title IX religious exemptions and things like that. So it's really doing a deep dive on so many of these pieces. I don't want to give too much away because I want everyone to be excited about the
people
mystery.
Need to listen.
But that's like a little, you know, a little bit of what we've got going on with On God's Campus.
And do you want to shout out the artist who did your amazing logo? Where'd that come
sure
from?
Do. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, that was Chloe, who you mentioned earlier.
And fantastic.
Chloe's last name is actually pronounced Guillo. So I'm just gonna Chloe Guillo.
Like on the maybe it's just in the sound mixing, I heard it wrong because I thought it was Guillo, and then I thought I heard it in the episode with a hard T. So all right.
I hope I was not right
the first time.
I hope not too.
We'll double check that.
But yeah, good for her. That's awesome.
Yeah, Chloe is the logo looks great. Chloe is a wizard. Does wonderful work, incredible work on socials and with graphic design and all a whole bunch of other things too. So yeah, big shout out to Chloe. And Chloe is our narrator on the podcast. So I think we have a good mix of voices and even some historical audio to have in there as well. So it's a good mix of all the things.
Very cool. Well, I can't wait to hear the rest of it. You're off to a great start. And for this being your first podcast, A+, way to go. So
thank you so much.
I'll take it.
All right. Yeah. Take care, everybody. Thanks again.
Great to meet you.
And hopefully I'll meet you sometime down in Portland.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for having me and Paul. Appreciate y'all.
Dave.
Yo.
It's great to meet like real life superheroes, isn't it?
Yeah, they were really cool. great perspectives. And I liked all the areas that we got into. We covered a lot of terrain on this issue in a short amount of time, relatively an hour. And I mean, as our listeners can hear, there are so many different angles and different rabbit holes that we could have gone down. You know, I feel like we're just touching the surface, but people need to listen to On God's Campus from Axis Mundi and get the rest of the story.
Yeah. It's great. You know, the way that they talk about it, I mean, you know, it lets you know that, you know, this isn't just some abstract thing. It's about real people's real lives. And there's so many affected by these restrictive schools and what they're able to get away with in the name of freedom of religion. And so it's really great to see an effective team like them, like Reap involved in this and really, you know, committed to be involved with this for the long term. You know, they're really doing great work, and I'm so glad that they're out there.
Yeah, it was great to meet both of them for sure. So everybody, right after you listen to this, you got another podcast to listen to. Episode 2 of their show should be out. So yeah.
All right. The outro.
Yes.
We are professionals, folks.
I can do the outro. This has been another episode of Veterans of Culture Wars. Thank you so much for listening to us. Wherever you like to get podcasts, please leave us a rating and a review, as that helps others find the show. Also, Patreon, VCW Pod, please support the show, as Zach and I work really hard to book guests and come up with questions and deliver these interviews. So if you want to support the show, please do. And we do Patreon only episodes. We're going to have one of those up fairly soon. So if you want to become a Patreon member and listen to that, you certainly can. We are on the X app, formerly known as Twitter, or still known as Twitter, really, at Dave J. Lester, at Muzach, M-U-Z-A-C-H, and at VCW Pod if you want to follow our show. We're also on the Blue Sky app, so check us out there. Zach is at muzach.bandcamp.com, where you can listen to his music that he puts out and buy a vinyl Christmas record. It is October. We're coming up on Halloween. You can order the vinyl Christmas record and get it in time for Christmas this year. And that's going to be so much fun.
Or if you're in the Seattle area, you can go to Silver Platters in Soto or Linwood, and they have physical copies there.
Whoa! It is at Silver Platters. That means you're official. Like, wow. That's...
It's called consignment, Dave.
Okay.
But, you know,
we are an honest show.
Bandcamp just fired 50% of their employees, all the unionized ones, after a different company bought them. And so we don't know what's going to happen there. But for now, you can buy the record on Bandcamp. We'll see.
All right, so everybody should check that out. If you are a fellow Bible nerd, you can listen to my other podcast, Does the Bible Say That, and nerd out with me on the Bible on that show.
And you can listen to my other podcast, does the Bible say that, which is a response show where I listen to Dave's show, Does the Bible Say That, and I talk about whether in the episode he says certain things. So does the Bible say that? It's going to be on all the platforms.
Yes, wherever you like to get podcasts.
All right, enough of this nonsense. Thank you for coming on down to VCW. Remember, as always, the podcast is free. The Patreon podcast, which we're about to record one right now, is not free. It exists. It is not free. But you still need to tithe 10%.